Hello, and thank you for listening to this Analyst Insight podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to both the regulars and the first timers. Half of those folks know what to expect, and the others have no idea what's about to happen, but in a good way. I hope you all keep coming back as we are going to be trying out some different ideas and formats this year. Would welcome your feedback, thoughts on how we are doing. Are we making good progress? Are there good things here you're listening to? But if there is something you feel need to share, get in touch. mark.ward@securityforum.org is the address for any comments, ideas, or requests to join in. And this episode returns to an issue we've dealt with a few times on the podcast, and that is AI in its various forms. We'll be talking what it is, how it might develop, and what you can do about it. And we have just the right folks to explore this issue, experts in all different aspects of that topic. My name is Mark Ward. I do research at the ISF, and I am not a deep fake. I do feel like I need to say that because there seems to be a lot of work being poured into that particular development at the moment. Imposter syndrome, yes. Deep fake, no. And hopefully none of the other guests here are deepfakes either. Our first guest is Ingvar Uglund, who's currently Executive Vice President of the New Tech Lab at DNB. That's Norway's largest bank, amongst other things. And he's a veteran of security engineering. Hello, Ingvar. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. What AI topic are you looking at? Deepfakes, things like that? Is that causing you issues? Or yeah, I'm curious about your work at that New Tech Lab.
Yeah, so first a few words about New Tech Lab. So New Tech means in our case whatever has not been widely adopted by others in the banks is a very fluent term, and AI has been New Tech for a long time. It's just that now AI is in everyone's hands. So now we look at AI in different applications or different ways to utilize AI in. Instead of just optimizing quality and improving productivity, so we're doing we like to call ourselves the moonshot unit at DNB, and that means like trying to look at what entirely new or genuinely new opportunities do these new technologies like AI span out, and then what can we do within that new space that couldn't be done before, or what would be hard to imagine without those technologies. That means there's a new opportunity space for good, and there's also an opportunity space for bad. And we're trying to figure out if we're going to do all these new great things that we couldn't do before, then we're sure that the kind of the evil side would try to do the same things. So we're trying to figure out and show, bring awareness of how can these tools help kind of the evildoers to spread misinformation and potentially, I live in Norway, we're a very high trust society, but trust is fragile. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, trust is one of those things that it takes ages to build up, but easy to wipe away, unfortunately. And also here is Lee Munson, a principal researcher at the ISF, who's getting started on a series of papers about AI. Hello, Lee.
Hello, Mark.
Thanks for coming back. Thanks for reappearing on the podcast. How's the project going? I think you're at the very early stages of it at the moment.
Yes, I'm right at the beginning at the moment, but that's not a bad thing. The first short and sweet paper is going to look at how the world has changed since we last wrote about demystifying AI in 2019. And it's going to ask members what topics they'd like us to review in detail.
Yeah, because I used that 2019 paper in some work I did on machine learning. It was a good starting point, but it was amazing how much has changed in 5 years, and even in sort of 6 months as well. I mean, sort of it's just proceeding so fast.
Yep, you're absolutely right. It's a very fast-paced area of cybersecurity at the moment. It's interesting. As Ingvar mentioned, it's full of opportunity as well as risk.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, definitely one of those double-edged swords, to coin a cliche, yes. But also here is Luka Ivezic, one of the ISF's lead cybersecurity consultants who has studied AI in the past. Hello, Luka. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. So what, I think you looked at misinformation and disinformation. Was this for an MSc?
That's right. It was for a master's from the Department of War in London. So I actually started off looking at the security implications of AI and nation states and kind of organizations in the West. And that actually led to me becoming a cybersecurity expert. So my interest in AI predates my interest in security.
Right.
So I kind of looked at what what in the lab settings, what kind of tools and capabilities were able to be done by AI at the time in 2015, 2016 or so. And I was shocked by what I saw just in terms of what it would mean when criminals got access to these tools, state operatives got access to these tools, and how it could impact kind of the security of organizations as well as the security of our society overall. And that kind of led me down the rabbit hole that is
Right. And
cybersecurity. So
are you
that's
more
been quite a
shocked
while.
now? I imagine there's more that they could do these days.
I think the capabilities and the end results are quite the same. The
Okay.
ease and the ability for a layman to achieve the same kind of impact or the same kind of results that you had to have a security engineer in a lab or an AI engineer in a lab in 2015 is what surprises me the most. Kind of the speed at which it became mainstream is what has shocked me about the development of AI since 2015 to now.
Yeah, I see you nodding there, Ingvar. So is that, I guess, what you're looking at? Just the that consumerization of this stuff makes it easy for the bad guys to use and lift all those problems that they can cause?
Yeah, it's kind of it's a multiplicative factor when you consider that now even, for example, a teenager can create deep fakes of politicians, CEOs, CFOs, etc., with just very basic knowledge and technology and no kind of barrier keeping them from doing using it.
No, that's very true. Yeah, because I saw one company, I can't remember the name of it, but they said, send us 2 minutes of video and we can make a deep fake of you saying anything. And they had some really quite good examples of it, which is pretty scary. I don't know. Ingvar, have you seen that? Just the lots more people using this stuff to produce more convincing things, I suppose.
Yeah, like you said, there's a bunch of like services where you can just you have people do this for you, and even with ChatGPT, it became for everyone, and we're seeing more and more like easy to use self-service type of services to do like deepfakes and so on. But also, if you want to build your own stuff, I mean, well, most of this is based on open published research, and there's open source models and so on. And it's pretty easy to if you have a pretty skilled tech team. It takes a few weeks to come up with something that is pretty astonishing. And that's I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. I think this might be the second time in our history that we've seen exponentiality in practice. The first example was COVID. Like if I bring the virus to two other people and so on, that's exponentiality in practice. But I think we're seeing the same thing with AI and generative AI in particular. And that means it's hard for us with our kind of limited linear brains to grasp what that would mean. And someone, I think it was Jack Clark, who's one of the co-founders of Anthropic in San Francisco, he said that I think both you, as in you, general people, and they, that some of the best people in the world on this, would be more surprised about the capabilities we'll see of these tools than we could ever have imagined. And that's something to digest, right? So.
Yeah, but I do wonder about that because having been a technology journalist, I saw a lot of stuff come and go, and a lot of it was really overhyped and just did not have the impact that we thought it would. But I wonder, with AI, I didn't ask all of you this, I suppose, are we at one of those World Wide Web or transistor type moments? Is this a genuine new thing, or is it yet to be proven how much influence it's going to have? Don't Lee, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I actually think it is a genuinely new thing that will have massive repercussions in the future. In terms of hype, I think it's indicative of the cybersecurity industry at large. Most of it seems to be coming from vendors, I think. They seem to want to cram AI into every new product title at the very least.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I do remember a quote by Groucho Marx about Doris Day. For the younger members in our audience, Groucho Marx was a comedian, a film comedian, and Doris Day was an actress. This is from quite a while ago. And Doris Day made a living, not a living, but her reputation by playing clean-cut sort of wives and mothers of people. And Groucho Marx said he knew Doris Day before she was a virgin and was playing those types of roles. And I think same with a lot of IT companies now. I knew them before that they were so apparently committed to AI. It seems to be one of those things that all of a sudden they've discovered, yeah, we were this all along. And they weren't. There's an awful lot of hype there. Now, Luca, do you see that? Is it a genuine game changer, or again, to coin a cliche?
I think it is a game changer in the same way that I would consider kind of the transistor and the World Wide Web. Well, more so the World Wide Web to be a game changer in that you have these usually, I mean, the transistors and the web were the domain of very specifically skilled people within niche institutes that worked on it for decades. And the big changes in society came when the World Wide Web became usable by the mainstream population. And then you had the whole kind of imagination and the capabilities and the invention of the entirety of all the people who could access it suddenly multiplied 100,000, million-fold in terms of how many users can use it. And that's when we saw some of the really kind of the applications of the World Wide Web that have changed the world to this day. So I'm thinking something similar could be happening with AI, where you've suddenly released these tools out in the wild. Well, ChatGPT, OpenAI did recently, in terms of generative AI, and that is actually usable by people. And a lot of small companies, cottage industries of, you know, prompt engineers, consultants, etc., are working on kind of exploring different ways of using this, and they're going to come up with stuff that we haven't considered before and will make complete in 10 years. You know, it'll be like, oh, why did nobody ever do this before or use this tool in such a way? Of course, it makes sense. Like, how could we have ever lived without, you know, Amazon or something, right? Okay. But it's going to be the same situation in 10 years, I think, because the technology itself is not fully revolutionary. The fact that everybody can use it and kind of manipulate it, isn't it?
Yeah. I remember search before Google was out, and that was hellish. And so, before Google. But Ingvar, I don't know. You said obviously AI been around for a while, but yeah, is it just hitting its stride now?
So you asked about hype. Yes, it's definitely hype, and I think we'll see what we in Norwegian call a belly splash, like a big anticlimax. I don't know if this is going to be in the year or 2 years, but I think we'll do the accounting and figure out that all the people that were we were expecting this so many people to lose their jobs, and then it didn't really happen, and people were saying you're going to get a 50% increase in productivity. It never happened. And then it's going to be so it was just a fad, and then they carry on. AI was just like so I expect that to happen, but that's because we're chasing short-term opportunities. We're trying to apply AI to what we're already doing. But in the longer term, and I don't know if it's going to be 10 years or maybe 10 years is just 5 years now because the future is closer. If it's 10 years or 5 years or 15 years, but I'm sure that this will change the world and the way we think about technology and perhaps even about ourselves more than we can possibly imagine. But it'll take longer than we expect. And I think there will be this anticlimax on the way. And that's classic Amara's law. Like we overestimate the impact in the short term and we significantly underestimate its impact in the longer term. And the longer term might be shorter this time. It doesn't have to be 20 or 30 years like it was with the internet. Maybe the internet turning point was like with mobile internet and social media, where it basically became for everyone. But this happened from, paper was... Was it 2017? It took a short time until someone managed to get that into something. 2019, GPT-2 was out there. It was terrible. It could barely count reliably to 10. And then GPT-3 was impressive. And then we're seeing it. So it's a classic example of Amara's law. But expect an anticlimax. But in the long term, be it 10 years or whatever, it's going to have significant impact on the way we live.
I think I'm seeing kind of the same trend that you might historically have seen in terms of the dot-com boom, where suddenly every single business had to spend extreme amounts of money setting up a website and then realizing that, only 500 people were actually interested in listening to a radio online or something like that. And then Mark Cuban sold it for billions. I think it was like $1 million per customer, per user of the site was the valuation of the company at the height of the dot-com boom. So you have a similar element here. There's a frenzy. There's people are overestimating how revolutionary it's going to be right now to all of these businesses that are investing in it. And again, just like the dot-com boom, it's going to be something like social media, something revolutionary is going to come out of it that we hadn't considered before, that we hadn't expected before.
Yeah, I think you're right. Certainly having covered the dot-com boom, the boom and the bust, I certainly get that feeling at the moment, seeing a lot of companies. There's a website called There's an AI for That, and scrolling through that gives me that very much a feeling of, why would I want to use AI for that? Because I remember a site, and maybe it's still going, I'm pretty sure it's not, this site, some entrepreneurs who had some domain names in the dot-com years, and they wanted to sell cheese online. At that time, crazy idea, never going to work. Clearly it works now. But they were just so, gung-ho. They were like, I was like, dude, you're doomed. This is just not going to work. And it didn't, as far as I'm aware. But no, Lee, just to think about, so are you seeing that sort of from members, just the casting around for uses of this stuff? Or is it one of those things that's being done to companies and they have to try and cope with it?
I'm at the early days of my research at the moment, but the vibe I'm picking up right now is organizations are worried about AI because they think they should be worried about AI, not because they're perceiving a particular threat. And I do wonder what role other elements have had in that. There's a PR and a national media input that's causing that, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Some of the conversations I had with members was about some of the senior managers within organizations saying, we must be able to get some use out of this, go and find some. And it was like, well, that's not the right way to do these things, is it? And then, so I think you're right, there's a certain amount of, we should be worried about it because it's happening, but we don't know why or what we're going to do. But I don't know, Ingvar, have you seen that sort of just some of your work? Is it hard to justify some of the uses of this because there's better ways to do it? Or is it people just want AI no matter what?
There's some exuberance here. And now, because you don't really have to be a hardcore technologist to start using these tools, there's a lot of PowerPoint architects and PowerPoint technologists out there. And now all of a sudden, they can just go to their users and say, well, look at this. Let's sit down and brainstorm all the things we can do with this in your daily work. And that's like, okay, it's like putting a paper form into a PDF. It's like that's not digitalization as such. That's basically what we're doing. What everything is running after, and that's because it promises short-term benefits. But it's also that means you have to deliver on that. I've yet to see the results of those optimizations, but it takes much longer time for like Luca mentioned. In 10 years, there's going to be these type of things that, why didn't we think about that in the first place? And these are the things that are obvious in retrospect, but they're almost unimaginable in prospect. And that's kind of the chorus line for the moonshot type of innovation that we do. We're not looking for the things that you can ask your customers about. Because, as the cliche goes, it was never the breeding of faster and faster horses that gave us the locomotive. Entirely new technology, but it was also driven by totally different people than horse breeders. Because if you gave the steam machine to the horse breeders, they would probably use it to heat up the stall. Yeah. But the locomotive was, if you look at it, it seemed like a pretty bad idea. Because it couldn't take you from A to B, it could only take you from C to D, and between C and D, there has to be rails. So, but in retrospect, it was obvious.
Yeah, because I was having a conversation with someone who said, surely the whole point of AI is just to make people better at thinking. And I said, no, surely it's to find completely new ways of appreciating language and developing different ways to understand things and better ways to understand things, because humans are limited in all kinds of ways that we don't want to replicate. And I think that's the problem with a lot of AI at the moment. It's based so much on human activity, mainly text, that's where all you're getting really is condensed people, really. And I guess that's what drives some of the deepfake stuff, is that it's all about reproducing some of what we've already seen, and it's not particularly creative, I don't think.
Yeah, it's a little bit like... the first TV shows was just radio on TV. Radio
was that's really true. Now, yeah. People stood around a microphone talking, basically. Is that what podcasts have become? Sudden flash. Yeah, maybe we need to reimagine these kinds of things. Well, I don't know. But Luca, Lee, are you members? Sort of the questions you're getting asked, the interviews you're doing, I'm curious about some of their problems they're having. Is it you know, the bad guys, are they capitalizing on this? Are they the innovators here? Have they seen some good stuff to exploit and abuse?
So I've been talking to the members of the service team. I do talk to a lot of members quite regularly. What I've been surprised by is that we've had a few members who weren't kind of, it's not a strategic target. You know, the companies that they're working for are not globally famous, not particularly kind of big ticket Fortune 500 item kind of corporations, but they've been hit with, for example, one member has been hit by an attack where there was audio deepfakes of their CFO and their CEO. The deepfakes were asking the financial controller at the company, one of them, to kind of send, a few hundred thousand or something euros to certain accounts for certain expenses. So it was a classic social engineering attack using these kind of deepfaked audios. And what struck me was that it's coming out of these kind of smaller companies that, you know, I wouldn't expect them to be the first hit. But that's just showing you that, you know, it's going to, the tools are available now. They're being used by small-time criminals. And, it's very, probably very interesting in terms of national secure agencies and top Fortune 500s. Like, what they're dealing with must be on a completely different level as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of work being put into deepfakes. I don't believe, is that particularly the things you're hearing about? Or is it, like you say, it's more a strategic process workflow type thing that's bothering people?
I'm actually seeing an interesting situation in which the attacks that are being seen are largely text-based phishing that have been enhanced with language models. The attacks that are being worried about are ones that are theoretical but not actually being seen in the wild. And some organizations are questioning, how do they bring in AI defenses, but perhaps they're not that great at articulating what is the business problem they're trying to solve? So there needs to be a lot more strategy around where they're going with this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I guess that's a bit reactive because there's no big wave of attacks and things like that. It's pretty sort of point specific and things like that. Well, I don't know, Ingvar, for a bank, is this deepfakes a particular problem? Because are you worried about fake customers or real customers being faked? I don't know if this is on your radar.
Well, clearly it is, but it's more like, how can we be well prepared before they materialize? Banks as an industry and a lot of other highly regulated industries are not that fast at turning around. So it's important to be aware early and manage to prepare well. We don't know if it's going to be a significant type of threats, but if it becomes, then we better be prepared. And then that goes for a whole spectrum of possible ways of attacks. But it's we still have when you're shutting down most of your physical branches, you're turning most of it to chat, and in between there's like you can talk to someone on the phone. It goes both ways. Like if that's being intercepted, you can be exploited as a customer, but also the other way around. We've seen that the technology is available to do that, but I don't have any statistics that show that it is a significant problem yet. So I wouldn't expect that. But
but as you say, it was a good point about that physical contact between yourself and your bank is breaking down. I think, I've been ourselves and all kinds of things. So yeah, those video based or screen based interactions probably going to get more regular, more popular. But because there's a couple of startups I've seen which are claimed to be sort of want to be that filter for video chats, no matter what format, so they can spot deep fakes as one of those arms races that's being starting to spring up. But yeah, but I wonder from on the bad side, are we seeing the bad guys really starting to adopt this stuff? Or I don't know if you're seeing that, or you mentioned those theoretical attacks. Is it academics or working on these things and saying, well, it is possible, but the bad guys are just making more of phishing and doing the things that do make a difference that they're familiar with. That's what you're seeing more of.
Yeah. So the early feedback I've got is it is mostly phishing, text-based phishing. Are the actual attacks in operation today? There are a lot of theoretical attacks out there. One of the biggest concerns I've come across is how agent ecosystems reduce human interaction in decisions. And there's a concern about these agents then starting to interact with each other and almost omitting humans from decision-making altogether. That's quite an interesting angle that I need to look into more.
Yeah, and that's sort of automation of processes within information security, just generally across any organization, I guess.
More in general, really.
Because in Threat Horizon, we did look at a couple of research projects which suggested companies, enterprises, businesses could become generative agents, basically, and just, they interact with each other. And that, I wonder what that would produce. I'm not sure that would be a good thing.
No. I mean, it's hard to get a crystal ball out, but when you've got machines interacting with machines and there's little to no oversight involved, I don't think it ends particularly well.
No, because you get all kinds of weird results with these right now with generative AI. It's not particularly great at something. So if they start making decisions, who knows where that's going to lead them.
Yeah, we're all obviously highly aware of the biases that come with some AI models. And there's questions about data poisoning as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Ingvar, I don't know if you've seen that, sort of just your work on these moonshots and stuff. Do you have to do a lot of care and curation of the data that's feeding into these things? Are you worried about those biases and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, definitely. But we've been in a position or in a situation for a long, long time where big data fueled algorithms or AI have been reserved for a few big techs in Northern California, mostly search and social media. The bias and the kind of misuse of big data sets has been around for a while. We just haven't been able to do something about it, or we haven't been willing to care because we like their services. But now with ChatGPT, it's available for everyone. You're starting to see how much power we lay in the hands of the vendor, and then the way they try to guardrail these models, it's basically OpenAI with ChatGPT that says this is how we look at the world. This is what we consider helpful and not helpful, and this is what we consider harmful and not harmful. And that's their worldview that is basically put into the guardrails of those models. So we're spending some time on seeing how can we govern them by ourselves, starting from scratch with open source models, and make it more like not just the Norwegian worldview, but also the banking and financial services worldview. What would it take to make a large language model your best, basically your financial co-pilot, your best friend advising you on how to spend your money, instead of just make sure you don't being racist and stuff.
Yeah, because there's a few apps I use, and I occasionally think, it'd be nice if this was some kind of advisor or something like that. But equally, then I think I just rebel against it. I think I've become like a surly teenager and just say, no, I don't want to do what you're telling me. I want to do my own thing. Yeah. Stick it to the man. That's what it's all about. But I guess that's part of what you have to get right, isn't it? Just, sort of that interaction.
I think it's interesting in the financial sector because you've already had the algo trading that led to the flash crash in 2012, 2013. So it's already been a big part of the finance world. And, if they do end up using more kind of creative versions of AI than the current kind of very strictly defined algorithmic ones, there could be a real kind of change in how the finance world is run. And, they could operate on their own basis, on their own kind of competitive level, so to speak. If you think about Go or chess, the AI is playing at a level way beyond what humans, what mere mortals can understand. And when you said the buyer and buyer, the kind of agent interactions, I'm also looking at the financial markets like, okay, what if we end up just kind of cutting out the humans because the humans are not competitive enough, not fast enough, not able to react to their prices enough, and it's just kind of AI trading against each other? Or is that already a reality, Ingvar, in the financial markets, if you might know or not?
I'm not an expert on that, but I think it's a fair analogy because when it comes to decision making, you can, In traditional companies, you write a memo and someone reads it and decides on it based on a discussion. That memo can easily be created in much higher quality by generative AI. And also it can be consumed and considered better from a large language model. And then, as you know, there are people advocating that every CEO should have an AI COO and an AI CMO and an AI, you know, CFO. And that means that you can get a lot of good advice in addition to your human-based CFO and CMO. But ultimately, you could ask, why don't you just have an AI CEO or an AI board? And even if you're a CEO that runs the company and you have all these people in your management or people, ultimately, you're not sure how this output have been produced. What's the background for it? What's the reasoning? And if we end up in a position where decisions are being made, like on that level, not just on transactions, like micro level transactions by algorithmic trading. If it's happening on company level, it might also happen on political level. And if we're making decisions where we're not sure why the information we're basing the decision on is as it is, then we're basically losing our autonomy. And that's a significant concern from my side. It's more plausible scenario than AI making automated warfare and go rogue that way, because there are ways to deal with that. But losing our autonomy indirectly by leaning too much on and depending too much on AI-based generated information is a significant threat and concern of mine.
Yeah, it's much more subtle, much more pernicious in the long term as well. Just, yeah, you don't know why. And it's hard to understand why as well. Not just from the people using it point of view, but the people that it's doing things to as well. I mean, that seems a dangerous thing. But just to round up, folks, I mean, is there a way to come to terms with AI? How should we approach this? Should we be scared? Should we be welcoming it with open arms? Should we, I for one, welcome our new robot overlords? Is that's where we should be going? Lee, I don't know, you're smiling at that, so I don't know. Have you welcomed the robot overlords already?
I think in general, it's business as usual. It's do your research. It's have a strategy. Know why you want to integrate AI into your organization. Don't just do it because it's the latest buzzword. But on a personal level, I'm going to go home and ask my computer if it fancies a game of chess.
Sorry, Dave, can't do that. Luca, are you facing the future with a smile on your face or with a spear in your hand?
I think it's a bit difficult to say from a cybersecurity perspective. As we've said, we haven't really seen any of those sophisticated or mass scale attacks. What I looked at in 2015, 2016 was, for example, mass spear phishing. The AI was able to scrape the internet for your personal details, your friends, your family, etc., and create a set of emails that would replicate your friends' potential email addresses, names, topics, things you might talk about, you know, the fact that you went to university together or something like that. So I haven't really seen any of this kind of mass AI-enhanced spear phishing, for example. I haven't seen a lot of these attacks come. I think they will be coming in the future, and it's going to require quite a redirection of how we work as cybersecurity professionals in terms of how do we in the security company and how do we make sure that these kind of more subtle attacks are dealt with on a regular basis. In terms of the AI in companies and so on, I think it's going to be the same as the World Wide Web. It's not going to change things. It's not going to revolutionize things in terms of like completely changing how we live, but it's going to help society in certain ways and hinder societies in other ways. So it's going to be a net neutral, I would say, overall.
Ingvar, are you, as a man with your hands on the technology, are you happy about the future or worried?
Well, the listeners can't see my t-shirt, but it's that AI apocalypse now. So inspired by Francis Ford Coppola's phenomenal movie.
Indeed. I love the smell of victory in the morning.
Yeah. Also a fantastic character. But I'm an optimist. I think there's an overwhelming probability that AI will make the world better for most people. And I think there's a tiny chance that things go so severely wrong. And I think we just need to make sure that we do whatever we can to mitigate that chance. And I think we're in a good position because ministers and everyone is talking about one set of technology in a way we've never talked about anything before. Even in banks, we haven't talked about cryptocurrency at the level of significance the way we talk about AI. And again, politicians and everyone. So I think we're in a much better place now than we could have been. These technologies have been, well, call it AI or whatever you want, but I think it's big data driven algorithms that are learning from behavior, and that have been reserved for big techs for a long time, and we just closed our eyes, and we didn't do anything with it. With the advent of ChatGPT and the research preview when that came out, it was an eye opener, and I think that was good. So I'm an optimist.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody. So yeah, I think just to sum up, it remains just to follow up on Ingvar's moonshot work and just looking at the potential for AI. I think it remains to be seen whether it's a small step or a giant leap, just what AI is going to do to us. But thanks for listening. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Look for our page on Audioboom, but obviously we're out there as well on Spotify, all those other, and Apple Podcasts. Just search for the Analyst Insight Podcast and you should find it. Podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.